Westchester Talk Radio is broadcasting live.
Live from G. Griffin Wine and Spirits in Rye, New York, Westchester Talk Radio presents the October edition of Talking Real Estate with host Leah Carroll. This is Jim Cleefield speaking. Talking Real Estate is produced by Shark Creative and made possible by Entergy, Indian Point Energy Center. Hightower Westchester, your wealth is managed to a fiduciary standard. White Plains Hospital, exceptional every day. Westchester County Office of Economic Development, Robeson, the house that Service built, and Accorda Therapeutics, Life Science. And don't forget, please download the Westchester Talk Radio app on iTunes through the App Store at Westchester Talk. You can like us on Facebook at Westchester Talk Radio, and please follow us on Instagram. You'll find us there at Shark Creative. And now, here's your host, Leah Carroll.
Thanks, Jim. Welcome, everybody.
That's new.
Welcome, everybody, to the October edition of Talking Real Estate with Leah Carroll. I, of course, am Leah Carroll, president at Park Sterling Realty, headquartered in beautiful Bronxville Village. Broadcasting today, though, off-site, and we're going to get to that in a minute. You know, I love to take the show on the road. Of course, I have Kevin Kearns with me from RMS Mortgage.
Thanks for having me.
Wait for it. NMLS number 175711.
Fully compliant.
We're usually broadcasting from Park Place in Bronxville, which we love, and we love all of Westchester, but occasionally we take the show on the road, which we've done today. We were up in Rye, New York, at G. Griffin Wine and Spirits, which is, I have to say, if you can have a favorite wine and spirits store, this is mine.
This is mine too. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and it's a great little shop. If you've not been here, it's at 498 Forest Avenue in Rye. And I'm just looking around the shop, and he's got, you know, great little signs, a quaint drinking village with a fishing problem. When the sky turns pink, it's time for a drink. And just that's just the start. A huge selection of wine, great liquor room as well. And we're going to be talking to the owner in a little bit. So stay tuned for that.
Heaven on earth.
As usual, I'm going to lead off with a disclaimer that real estate is local. Every house on every street in every town is different. Today we're going to speak in generalities. If you have very specific questions about your house on your street in your town, speak to your realtor. And if you don't have a realtor, speak to me. So where are we? Well, it is October, mid-October, and that means the statistics from Q3 are in as we enter Q4. And, you know, top-line takeaway for the real estate market in Westchester County is that it's still vibrant. The median sale price does continue to rise at a healthy, steady level, but inventory remains low, and especially in some segments. And these are trends that we've been talking about for 12 to 18 months. I mean, Kevin's been by my side for 2 years now, and he knows that the message has not changed that much. Now, all that being said, but when we drill down on the numbers, we continue to see what we've been talking about. The million-dollar-plus market is soft. It's definitely a buyer's market in that segment. And that the mid-range we've described, generally, you know, again, markets are different, but from 500 to 900,000.
Yeah, that's been hot for us.
It's been hot for, you know, 18
and
months.
Still hot, I should say.
And still hot, exactly. So in thinking about the high-end being continuing to be soft, if you're a move-up buyer, now is your time to buy. And last month we had Michael Shapit from New York City visiting with us to talk about the New York City market, and he was talking about how tremendously soft it is in the city kind of across the board.
And how the rental market is so strong down there, which was very surprising.
He said he didn't see the parallel of Manhattan and Westchester, which is not common. Normally it runs very parallel. So if you're thinking about empty nesting and going back to the city, now is your time.
That's right.
So the high end continues to struggle, but there are some segments that have made great gains. Let's talk about co-ops for a sec. The median sale price of co-ops went up nearly 6%.
Wow.
Year over year, and that's the highest gain in any segment, mm-hmm. With 2 to 4 family houses coming in just behind it at almost 6%. The number of sales year over year, co-ops are the only group that went down, and it went down 16%.
Is that right?
Yeah. So what does that mean? In fact, I got a call from a reporter earlier this week who led off with, "I see that the co-op market went down 16%. You know, what's happening? Is the co-op market crashing?" And it was like, "Whoa, steady on." Yeah. I'm going to tell you guys the same thing I told him, is that the number of units for sale in co-ops has drastically gone down.
Yeah.
So ergo, the number of sales you can possibly have has gone down as well.
And
the median sale price has gone up. So when co-op buyers, and a lot of co-op buyers are first-time home buyers.
Supply and demand, simple law, right?
It's exactly right, supply and demand. So they're out looking for a co-op, there's fewer choice, and the prices are higher, and so some of them chose not to buy. So that explains the 16% loss in the number of sales.
Absolutely.
But do not, and when you read the paper, when you read statistics, don't be confused by seeing 16% down and think the co-op market is struggling. The co-op market is actually doing very well and is probably one of the highest segments of the marketplace.
Yeah.
The next highest performing segment of the marketplace is 2 to 4 family houses. And, you know, that inventory is really, it's the lowest it's been in a decade. And yep. We've been talking about that. The prices are higher than they've been in a decade. Mm-hmm. And people can't get enough of them.
That's right.
And that segues beautifully to what we're going to be talking about in a little while with another guest we have here today. But here's some real numbers.
Fine choice in guests this year.
Isn't it, don't you think? So the number of available homes for 2 to 4 family houses are down 15%. Number of sales is up 6%. The median price is up 6%. So we've been talking to our multifamily sellers. And when I say multifamily for this conversation, mm-hmm. we mean 5 units and below. And right? And let's talk, and I'm going to segue to lending for a second. Because when we bring in Jim, and I'm not going to tell you who Jim is yet, but when it's a secret. When we bring in Jim, we're going to talk about 5 or 6 rather units and above.
Okay.
But let's talk about lending for a minute.
Sure.
For 2 to 5 family unit, mm-hmm. right, is still residential mortgages.
Yeah, some might stop at 4, actually.
Okay, so let's talk 2 to 4
not,
then.
Yeah, some might not go above a 4, and that's considered residential. That being said, we're seeing more of them, which is surprising. We're seeing a lot of owner-occupied multifamily. So not just true investment property, but some owners that are also renting out the units. But they're not occupied.
So I can tell you, we brought on 3 multifamily houses down in Southern Westchester in the last month, and all of them sold with multiple bids.
Wow.
And there seems to be a real appetite for multifamily, multifamily being 2 to 4 or 2 to 5 family houses.
Yep.
And a lot of them are getting financing. And now one of the things I do know that is the minimum down payment most of the time is 25%.
You do see a much larger down payment requirement on most on a multifamily. Yeah.
Is there ever a time when you can do less than 25%?
You could do, I've seen 20. For the most part, where we lend, we'll go to 20. But 25% is kind of the rule of thumb. And also the 5% additional down get you a much better mortgage program.
And do they take in the rents in the other units as part of the income towards that finance?
You can, yes. You
qualifying?
Can use that rental income, and then each loan program has its percentage of allowable income that you can use, 75% of the gross income, rental income you can use, generally speaking, for qualifying income.
Now, one of the houses we're selling has tenants in all of the units, but no leases.
Oh.
Just month to month. They've been there for years. They're great friends of the family now. Mm-hmm. And the bank asked about seeing leases to qualify the income.
Yeah.
Without a lease, do we have a big problem?
Oh, God. It does, depends on your underwriter. It depends on what... I've had sellers actually provide statements that can prove that they had continually received payments from these people. So an end around there, that's more of a one-off than a regular occurrence. But more often than not, they're going to require a lease and seeing not just your rent that you plan to receive, but also now your appraiser needs to provide an appraisal that shows your market rents for the area and that they kind of coincide with one another.
And if I don't have leases in place, is it too late to produce leases?
No, it's not necessarily, because you have a new buyer coming in to own that property. So you would need a lease executed with that new tenant anyway.
Okay, thanks. See, good to know.
See that?
So the multifamily market is very hot.
Mm-hmm.
And just to be clear, above 5 or 6 units is a whole different world.
Now it's commercial.
It's commercial real estate. And I think a lot of people don't realize that when we say commercial real estate, I think they're thinking stores and warehouses and buildings that are office buildings, restaurants.
Absolutely.
And that they're not thinking in terms of dwellings.
There is a funny way of kind of looking at this when you look at the residential side versus the commercial side. The residential side is extraordinarily consumer protection, bank beware. You better be taking care of these people and doing it the right way. Federally speaking, even state speaking, it now becomes on the commercial side, you're a business person, make a smart business investment. That's on you a lot of times to figure out. And your next guest, who will remain to be spoken about later, can talk to this
quite a bit. A secret guest.
But in our world, we have pretty stringent, lending laws that we've got to follow, whether it was a single family property, a 3-family, a 4-family, that we adhere to. It kind of becomes a buyer beware situation a little bit further along from disclosure purposes, things along those lines, when you go on and buy some of these commercial properties.
Excellent. Well, you know what? We're going to take our first break. When we come back, we are going to introduce Jim, but before that, we're going to talk to G. Griffin Wine and Spirit owner Doug Kaloris, who's going to tell us about what we should be pouring at our holiday tables and what's hot in liquor trends and all that good stuff.
Everybody knows I'm here, so when I head back to the office, I need to go back with a box that's filled with some products from G. Griffin. So.
Okay, you're listening to Talking Real Estate with Leah Caro on Westchester Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Look outside your window. What would you like to see? Imagine all the things that could be done to beautify your property. At Michael Labriola, we've led the field over 35 years. Our expert staff brings all their best to give you what you need.
For more than 40 years, Michael Labriola Incorporated has provided complete landscape construction and site development services that will add beauty, enjoyment, and value to your property. Want to make some changes to your landscape this spring? Maybe extending your living space to the outdoors with a functional outdoor kitchen or adding a patio or walkway? Michael Labriola Incorporated can evaluate your property and offer creative ideas. 914-273-6530. Commercial property is always welcome. Learn more at michaellabriolainc.com.
Michael Labriola, our last name is the first name in landscapes.
News, trends, and more.
No one knows Westchester County better than we do.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Talking Real Estate with Leah Caro. I, of course, am Leah Caro, president at Park Sterling Realty, headquartered in beautiful Bronxville Village, serving Westchester, Putnam, and Bronx counties. Today, we have taken the show on the road to Rye, New York, to G. Griffin Wine and Spirits on Forest Avenue, my favorite wine and spirit store in the world. And we are sitting with Doug Kaloris, the owner of G. Griffin Wine and Spirits. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you, Leah.
You're happy to be here?
Good to be aboard.
We're happy
beautiful
to have
Rye, New York.
It is beautiful.
Not as beautiful as Bronxville, New York, but almost.
Yeah, exactly. So, hey, and he has not been drinking yet, folks. Here's what, Doug, happy to have you. What we wanted to talk about was, you know, the holidays are approaching. We have Thanksgiving right around the corner, and then, you know, Christmas and all the other holidays in December. And, you know, I know that people every year come in here to get to buy their wine for their holiday tables.
Of course they do.
And so what can you tell me about what we should be looking at, what's hot, if anything, and what type of wine to be serving? Give us wine 101 for Thanksgiving.
Wine 101. You have red and white, and then there's a rosé, of course, sparkling. That's wine 101. So wine 102 would be Pinot Noir for Thanksgiving. Why, you ask, Leah?
I do ask why.
You don't like Pinot Noir.
I don't. And, you know, Thanksgiving...
What do you have against Pinot Noir? What did it ever do to you?
Thanksgiving is...
Pinot Noir did nothing to you. Pinot Noir for Thanksgiving because it goes with everything. The stuffing, the yams, the turkey. You might have ham on Thanksgiving. Pinot Noir goes with ham.
So let me ask you a serious question.
Here's a misnomer about wine for Thanksgiving. People think they should drink Zinfandel. Why do you think they...
Because
it's
poultry,
Zinfandel?
White wine goes with poultry.
Zinfandel's red.
I mean, well, I knew, but I'm trying to get to why are we drinking red on Thanksgiving?
Well, you could drink both. You could drink white and red, but most people drink red on Thanksgiving, white as well. But Zinfandel is believed to be an indigenous grape to the United States. False. There are no indigenous grapes to the United States or North America. Zinfandel came from Croatia in the 1700s. It happens to be the oldest grape in America. People like to drink Zinfandel on Thanksgiving.
Because it sounds so traditional and
like the pilgrims were smashing the grapes, blah, blah, blah.
But they weren't.
But Zinfandel survived Prohibition because they were selling the grapes from California to the East Coast to all those immigrants as produce. Guess what the immigrants did with the produce?
They squashed it up and made wine.
Bingo.
There we go.
That's why we have old vine Zinfandel in California. Hundreds of years old. Old vines make great wine, Leah.
Right. So
the older you get, the better the wine.
So at our Thanksgiving tables, we're going to serve a Zinfandel, I'm hearing. Also, a Pinot Noir goes with
If you like fuller wines, if you're like Leah Caro and you have something against Pinot Noir, I suggest Zinfandel.
So what will we be serving at my house on Thanksgiving?
Ooh. Barolo.
We'll be serving a Barolo. Okay.
Yes, from Italy.
Gotcha. Hey, so after Thanksgiving dinner, when we're putting out dessert, what's a nice dessert wine?
My favorite dessert wine in the world, Royal Tokaj from Hungary.
And tell me about that.
It's liquid gold.
It's a
late
white
harvest.
Wine.
No, it's a dessert wine.
It's a dessert wine.
Late harvest, huge sugar content. It is liquid gold.
Excellent. So that's good to know. So let me. So tell me what's happening in the world of spirits. You know, I say liquor, and as the shop owner here, you always correct me. You say spirits, not don't say liquor, say spirits. What's happening in the front of what's popular? Tequila, bourbon, whiskey?
Tequila is very popular right now. There's going to be a tequila shortage. Buy a lot of tequila.
Is that true?
Yes. A blue agave plant takes years to make. Most spirits, vodka, bourbon, they're made with corn. You know how fast corn grows? Pretty damn fast. You know how fast a blue agave plant grows?
Pretty darn slow.
And it can only come from?
Mexico.
Mexico.
Right. So tequilas are popular. What else?
Bourbon. Bourbon has been popular for the last 6 years.
I hear a lot about small batch or hard to get bourbons and tequilas. What makes something a small batch?
Supply and demand, Leah.
Supply and demand.
Multiple offers on a listing. Multiple offers on a bourbon.
Ah, okay. So there's really not that much difference.
Not that much difference.
Okay, that's good to know.
People want what they can't have.
Right. And now I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we're going to set you free to go back to sell to all these
folks. Having so much fun, though. Can't we keep going?
Hey, if I've been invited to someone's home for the holidays, and I need to bring a hostess gift.
Flowers are always nice. I like flowers. Oh, you mean in wine and spirits?
In wine and spirits.
Along with the flowers.
Yes.
Or chocolates. You could bring, if you don't know the spirit, because spirits are personal, right? You don't like bourbon. You like tequila, but someone might not know that. Bubbles. You should always have a bottle of champagne in your fridge.
Just to bring to someone else's home.
That's a safe bet. They might re-gift it when you leave, but bubbles is nice.
Yeah, that you know
but
what.
But if you give someone a bottle of tequila and they don't like tequila, it's just going to sit in the dusty corner for the next 10 years.
Right. That's really good advice. And as I look around your shop, I see you have all sorts of beautiful gift bags. And I know that you do custom wrapping for anyone who's coming in to buy a gift to bring out to it.
Lots of corporate gifts, too. We ship corporate gifts all over North America.
Excellent. And I know you do an engraving. Tell me about engraving.
Oh, we can engrave anything on any bottle. It takes a $20 bottle or a $100 bottle and makes it personalized.
But what kind of things do you engrave?
Fabulous 50, the man who acts like he's 50. We do trophies for golf outings. We do all kinds of stuff. We have a lot of realtors here in Rye who do it as closing gifts.
Isn't that clever? I think that's a terrific idea. And actually, I know a couple who do that as well. And they welcome their new owners to their home with a personalized bottle with their names right on it.
And if you just bought a house with a wine cellar, how amazing is that?
And will you help people decide what wines to put in the wine cellar?
Oh, absolutely. We actually move people's cellars from house to house, organize it, tell them what to drink, what to throw away, where they need to emphasize in.
Excellent. You know, I should truth be told here, folks, in full disclosure, the owner of G. Griffin Wine and Spirits, Doug Caloris, is also my husband. Why he's giving me such
that
a hard time. That's why he's giving me such a hard time.
I don't think I give you a hard time at all.
But
you wanna,
it's all relative.
I can give you a hard
time. No, please don't. But I have to say that the service that they provide here at G. Griffin Wine and Spirits, whether it's moving your wine cellar, helping you round out your collection.
My business is built on three simple principles. Service.
Absolutely. And he does give exceptional service to every single client.
You know, people settle for bad service. Why? Why is that?
I don't know.
Because they are used to getting bad service. So when you give them great service, it's like a brick to the head. And they keep coming back. Why do people ask if they can use their American Express? Don't ask me that. Of course you can. Stop putting up hurdles for people to spend their money.
Right, I couldn't agree more.
If you have earned the right to carry an American Express card, why would I say no?
Right, and yeah, I think that's terrific.
Yet there's so many businesses in Westchester
that don't take them.
Who put up hurdles.
That's true.
We break down hurdles here.
And I know you feel about service the same way we do at Park Sterling Realty. And I have to point out one more thing.
With a smile.
With a smile. Is that you also have a nice collection of dog treats back there.
We are dog friendly. It's easier to train a dog than it is a customer.
And I do know that's true, that there are dogs that come by and drag their owners in here.
They cannot walk by without stopping.
Without getting a treat in a bottle. So, hey, Doug, it's been great having you on.
It's been a blast.
So, thank you.
Can I come back on in a few minutes?
Sure. Can you tell everybody how to follow you on social media, where you're located, what are your hours?
G. Griffin Wine and Spirits at 498 Forest Avenue in beautiful Rye, New York. G. Griffin Wine and Spirits.com, Instagram G. Griffin Wine and Spirits, or you can follow hashtag Wimbulance.
That's right. He has a big, what do you have?
It's a Chevy pickup truck. It is the Wimulance for emergency deliveries only.
And you do deliver, is that correct?
We deliver.
Is there minimum order on delivery?
No minimum order, Leah.
Excellent. Good to know.
Doug, if you order pizza and a bottle of wine, we'll beat the pizza to the house.
I love it. I love it. You are terrific. So we're going to visit with you again in a minute, but thank you for being on. You're listening to Talkin' Real Estate with Leah Cara on Westchester Talk Radio.
At Indian Point, we've helped power Westchester and New York City for about 4 decades. Recently, as part of an agreement with New York State, we are working toward an early and orderly shutdown of the facility by 2021. Until then, we'll continue safely generating about 25% of the reliable, round-the-clock electricity that powers the city and Westchester, all with virtually no greenhouse gas emissions. Safety is, as it always has been, the top priority for everyone at the plant. We will continue to keep Indian Point fully staffed, and full-time inspectors from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission will monitor our daily operations. We'll also continue to play an important role in our community as a taxpayer and active participant in local charities. Indian Point Energy Center is still working for you, and it's our honor to continue to serve the people of New York. If you have questions about our ongoing operations, please visit safesecurevital.com.
Somers to Yonkers, Tarrytown to Portchester.
We've got Westchester covered.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
State with Leah Caro. I, of course, am Leah Caro, president at Park Sterling Realty, headquartered in beautiful Bronxville Village, serving Westchester, Putnam, and Bronx counties. We have taken the show on the road and are broadcasting today from G. Griffin Wine and Spirits on Forest Avenue in Rye, New York, my favorite wine and spirit shop. We did just speak to Doug Kaloris, owner and proprietor, comedian, and and chops buster, we'll call it that, who actually gave us some great information, a little history of wine, what to serve at Thanksgiving, plus why his company is different, and it's all about the service, folks. So as he would say, don't settle for bad service. Now I'm going to segue over, back in June, a sweeping new law went into effect nearly overnight, and one of the first voices to start the conversation about what it means to tenants and landlords and realtors and consumers was James DeBeanie. James DeBeanie is a working attorney and proprietor at James DeBeanie and Associates in Yonkers, and Jim and his associates handle every aspect of real estate law, including zoning and tax grievances, and of course real estate closings, and they are experts in handling tenant-landlord law. And since the new law went into effect this summer, it feels like Jim has spent hours and hours presenting information about the new law to, myriad different groups. So I could not be more delighted that he has taken time out of his super busy day and schedule to come to Westchester Talk Radio, Talking Real Estate with Leah, to talk about this new law. So, Jim, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Leah. It's a pleasure to be here, and really enjoyed the show. Doug is hilarious, and
he's something else.
Yeah, and the wine and spirits place you guys have here is amazing. It's just he's packing up a box of booze for me now, so my office will be happy to hear that, going back with some good bourbon.
Excellent. So before we get into the new law, tell me, I know it's talked a little bit about your company, but tell me what I missed,
Sure.
Let everybody know.
I've been practicing 21 years. I got into this after a former CPA, and I focus on real estate transactional work. That could be residential, commercial. As you had referenced earlier, four family, five family, and below is probably not considered commercial. And I also do a lot of civil litigation, so we're in Supreme Court on commercial contract, breach of contract matters on a daily basis throughout Westchester and the boroughs. We're in the Supreme Courts in those areas, as well as the local courts on landlord-tenant matters. But we are very heavily into the real estate transactional side, helping represent clients both on the buying and the selling, whether it's a co-op condo, house, multifamily house, commercial properties, warehouses, businesses, franchises. So we're heavily involved in that aspect of.
And you do tax grievance work as well, if somebody in your firm does.
We've tapered down on doing the tax grievance work. We're so overwhelmed with a lot of other things that we're doing.
Understood.
It's another specialty area that we don't really focus on right now.
Okay, understood. So we were talking right before we came on the air about the affordability factor in Westchester County and the city. We were talking about with rentals in particular, and in the years that I've been in real estate, which is a few. We've always kind of had this soft spot for tenants because they did, they have been required over the years to, you know, produce first month's rent, last month's rent, 2 months security, pet security. They're going to pay a commission potentially. And like the fees just stack on and add up. And all of a sudden, you know, they're paying nearly a down payment in some instances on a property. And so I totally get that Westchester and New York State are is an expensive place to live and call home. So in thinking about that, I get that, you know, that it needs to, we need to cut some the tenants a little bit of slack sometimes. Now, that being said, back in June, New York State and the government here also took a look at affordability and realized that it's tough, right?
Right, sure.
And went a little overboard, as government can do.
And sweeping changes.
And so what they did on June 14th, enacted a law that went into effect immediately.
Right. The Housing Stability Tenant Protection Act of 2019, for the most part, became effective on June 14th. And there were a few items that, that kicked in later in October 12th. But for the most part, as we sit here today doing this, everything is in effect.
Right. And what we have seen, and this is where I really want to get nitty gritty with you, what we've seen is that what for the, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Yeah. And so what started off as good intentions for helping the affordability crisis in New York has really some unintended consequences for landlords and owners of buildings, of commercial real estate buildings that we really need to address.
Yeah, there was a huge pendulum swing, and now it's become much more difficult for, you know, property owners who could be mom and pop, you know, owners who own 3, 4, 5, 6 family houses are now put in a very difficult position where they purchased the property with a certain understanding of how could they afford the property and what the projected rent increases would be over the course of the years. And with this passage of the new law, it put a huge set of brakes on all of that. And, you know, just for example, one example, if you have 6 units or more, those properties are typically, and if it was built before 1974, those properties were considered subject to rent stabilization. So this law that came out applies to both free market apartments which and houses. So it could apply to 1 family, 2 families, you know, huge co-ops in Manhattan to, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 a month rentals in, you know, in Rye or Bronxville or Scarsdale or wherever, Armonk. It applies across the board to all those housing and apartments that are rental, and so the rent stabilization law, which is 6 units or more, is hugely impacted by this new Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act. And one small example I'll give you is if you've got a tenant who's been living in an apartment for 30 years, and they vacate the apartment, and the tenant was paying, say, $500 a month, under the new law, the most you could increase that rent after making an investment of $15,000 to make improvements to that apartment, the most you could increase that rent is $89.29. So that means that the new apartment would be renting for when that tenant vacates, you renovate the apartment, you put it up for rental, instead of renting it for maybe $2,000, which may be the fair market value depending on what where you are in Westchester County, that apartment by law can't be rented for anything more than $589.29.
And that's just, I think, probably crippling for landlords who are relying on future income to sustain their buildings.
Right. For that apartment really was being subsidized by all the other apartments for many, many years. The heat, the utilities, the maintenance, the service, I mean, that cost far more than $500 a month. So that was being subsidized. So the intent, and when that owner bought that property, is someday that property would come back into inventory and the landlord would be able to rent it and bring it to close to fair market value, maybe not fair market value, but close to it. Under the new law, that's non-existent anymore. And it's become very devastating to landlords. And I could see it in my practice. As I mentioned, I do a fair amount of commercial transactional work. And commercial, I also refer to multifamily buildings. We have done very little transactions. There's very little sales going on right now. And in fact, prior to this law coming out, there was a lot of talk about it coming down the road. And landlords, savvy landlords, realized, or potential investors realized, that this law may be pretty bad, but no one knew it was going to be this bad. But as a result, the market had really died 6 months prior to, or maybe 8 months prior to, the June 14th release of the new law.
So let's break it down a little bit and kind of start, because this is a lot to digest.
Sure.
So I guess starting with, let's kind of tell the tenants now what the law means to them and what what their rights are and what they should be aware of. So if you're a tenant, and this could be if you're renting a single family house, it could be if you're renting a condo or a co-op or any portion of a multifamily house, the landlord can no longer charge any more, not a nickel more than 1 month security.
That's correct. So it would be the 1 month security and probably the first month's rent.
And they can't charge first and last.
Right. They can't do that. You can't take a pet fee. You can't take... you can't charge more than $20 for an for a credit check.
And does a credit check include a background check?
You can't charge more than $20
for any sort of screening tool.
Yeah, so the landlord has to absorb, or the realtor has to absorb the rest of the cost. The tenant's exposure is only $20. If in fact the tenant shows up, or the prospective tenant shows up and says, "Here, I have a credit check that was done within 30 days," you have to accept that.
So if I walk in with my Credit Karma credit check and it's less than 30 days old, you have to accept it.
You have to accept it. In other words, you can't charge them the $20. But if you choose to go ahead and do a credit check on your own, you know, I think you still be able to do that under the law. And the reality is that this law is brand new, and there's still a lot of gray area as to how it's going to be enforced, and it's going to take years before cases come down that further define or explain or clarify the true intent of the legislators when this law was passed.
And in fact, one of the gray areas that we deal with as realtors, and in fact with our consumers, is when you are renting a co-op or condo or any larger building that has a management company associated with it. Management companies charge substantial fees for applications frequently.
That's how they make
money. Of course, and that's how they pay their staff and run the paperwork and all of that. And I appreciate that, actually. I run a business. They run a business. And the question was, can management companies charge application fees? Because what they're arguing is, well, I'm not the landlord. I've been paid to. And so that is one of the gray areas that I know that I haven't gotten a clear-cut answer on.
Right. And under the original law, which came out June 14th, they did not have the right to do anything other than charge to $20. And then management companies were working on trying other ways to enforce collecting payments, whether that's through increased other fees that they'd be charging.
I imagine they'll pass it forward to the landlord.
Right, exactly.
Or the building.
Right. But it's my understanding, I think about a month ago, they modified that aspect of the law because they realized your point, and that's management companies, were not the landlords per se, and co-op businesses is obviously a huge aspect of it, and the costs are really more than just the $20 for a credit check. So they did accept that aspect of it with respect to co-ops. So some of the laws that are in the law have been rolled back as a result of the latest change.
So if you're a tenant, you should be aware that your landlord can now, new tenant, can only charge you 1 month security. They can't charge you first and last. They cannot charge you more than $20 for a credit or background check. They can't charge you an additional pet policy. So those are some good reforms for tenants, because affordability is tough. But
here's the playback. Here's the offset with that.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in the past, you would have a tenant who maybe his credit was on the fence, and landlords were like, you seem like a nice person, but your credit is horrible. I'll let you come in if you pay 3 months security. And the tenant would, some tenants would say, well, if they've got the money, yeah, that's great. I want this place really
badly. Because it's a great compromise as opposed to being told no.
Right, exactly. So now I think what some landlords are faced with is an automatic no, because you don't make the threshold for the credit. And now they're, and so maybe the backlash is that now the tenant doesn't get that apartment, where otherwise there were some options. And now there's no option.
And it's fine, even to take that one step further, I understand that if the tenant says, I know I have terrible credit, I'm offering to pay you 2 or 3 or 4 months in advance rent or an extra security, that the landlord can't take it even if it's offered and
not
asked.
That's correct.
Right, and so one of the unintended consequences is that landlords who would like to work with tenants maybe who are on the fence are now being really not given the ability to, and so we're still not housing a tenant.
Exactly.
And that's one of the... So that is kind of all of the stuff, or not all, some of the stuff that affects kind of that four-unit and under buildings or single-family houses. The landscape at 5 units and above has changed even more drastically.
Right. Well, 5, I think, as your earlier speaker Kevin. Today, Kevin, was talking about, for 5 units and above, that puts it into a category of commercial from a mortgage standpoint. But from a real estate legal standpoint, it's 6 units and above, puts it into a category of rent stabilized. And it's the rent-stabilized buildings that are treated, you know, differently than the fair market apartments. A lot of the laws are similar in terms of, you know, deposits and security deposits and so forth, but there's a lot more restrictions that are applied to the rent stabilization in terms of rates of increase in rents and what you could charge an apartment after a tenant vacates and what you could try to recoup in improvements that you make to an apartment.
So here's some questions I have for you, and I'd like to approach it as I'm a investor, mm-hmm. And because we do commercial real estate at Park Sterling Realty, and we get calls from folks who are interested in buying 10, 12, 20 unit buildings. So I want to talk investor buyers. I want to talk about people who currently own them and are planning to hold on to them and what they need to know, and then folks who maybe own them and are thinking maybe now is the time to sell. So let's start, I guess, with the middle group. I'm owner of a 9, 10, 12-unit apartment building. Yep. Let's call it Yonkers, maybe, you know, sure. Down County. We get a lot of folks who want to, and there's plenty of inventory, and those buildings exist.
Right.
What does this new law mean to them, like, about improving their building or the units or anything like that?
Very, very good question. I think from a purchase aspect, you no longer can just take a building and say, okay, I'm gonna pay $125,000 a door, or I'm going to pay 8, 9, 10 times the rent roll for a property. Now you have to dive down deep into the numbers, the documentation, the registrations for the apartments, because each apartment must be registered yearly.
Registered with whom?
With the Department of Housing and Community Renewal. It's a state organization, and it's for short, it's DHCR. And if you don't register yearly, then you have a problem. And so if you're a buyer looking to invest in a property, instead of just taking these general numbers, you know, $125,000 a door or, you know, 10 times the rent roll, now you really have to dive down and understand what, you know, was the property properly maintained in the past? Is all the documentation in good order? Have the registrations been done? Will you be able to fight an audit or a subpoena from THCR if it turns out they dispute what the rent being charged for a particular apartment? So you have to be much, much more careful. If you're an investor, you have to be more savvy. If you're relying on your attorney, you have to have an attorney who's just not a residential real estate attorney, because he will not understand the complexities of a commercial closing when you have to dive in and do the due diligence. And if you're being retained to do the due diligence, then you really have to understand the way this new law works.
And I couldn't agree more. You know, just as Kevin is a terrific residential mortgage lender, you know, he knows that, you know, he's got connections in the commercial world, but that's not his thing. And when we talk to folks who are exploring commercial real estate, we say, you know, you can't work with a residential real estate attorney. It's just not the same animal, and they really have to know what they're doing.
Yeah, some do both, but some don't. Most don't, I think. And that's where the investor gets into trouble, because they're not aware of what ETPA means, the Emergency Tenant Protection Act, and they're not aware of apartments being registered, requirement for being registered every year. And I have some clients come to me, they walk in the door and say, hey, you know, I've got this building, I've owned it for a couple of years, you know, and someone told me I just got this overcharge complaint from the Division of Housing Community Renewal. What does this mean? What it means is that, you know, there are mistakes made along the way, and now you're going to have to reconcile with them. And it usually means paying back tenants a significant amount of money, thousands and thousands of dollars, and what's possible rent overcharges. Any rent that's not registered is an illegal rent.
So if I'm a family and I've owned, we've owned a 6-unit apartment building for generations, because that's how we, you know, maybe we emigrated to the United States, and it was one of our first, we all pooled our money and bought this, and it's been, you know, and that's how wealth is built in the United States.
Of course.
How is this, all this crazy new information being conveyed to me?
Well,
I'm not I don't own a 400 unit building. I own a 6-unit building.
You know, it's a good question. I put out a newsletter every month or so to my clients and also prospective clients and vendors and referral sources.
Realtors. I'm on your mailing list.
Oh, awesome. Well, there you go. So I educate you on these new laws. But believe it or not, a lot of people still don't read it, don't understand it, don't. I wish they'd pick up the phone and ask the question or shoot an email back and say, hey, what do I need to be doing here? Because you could avoid a whole lot of problems down the road if you address them earlier on.
Now, there's a couple of a couple of acronyms. Yes. There we go. We are drinking wine here at G. Griffin today.
We have to slow down the wine.
Couple of acronyms.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate the wine.
that I've been hearing about that have to do with improving a building and or improving sure. individual units and yeah. how much I can recoup.
Yeah.
And there's like an MCI yeah. and a, can you talk about that?
Sure, I can. So MCI stands for major capital improvement, and those are improvements made to the entire building. For example, a new roof, new windows, new driveway, new courtyards, new a boiler. Those are considered MCIs, major capital improvements. In the past, you were able to, improve whatever you wanted to, submit an application or petition to the application to DHCR, the Division of Housing Community Renewal, and they would evaluate it, and then they would determine how much of an increase in rent would be applied to each tenant going forward.
Because they all benefit from the yeah. major capital improvement.
Yeah. And right? so there was an incentive for the landlord to make those improvements. The new law now created a disincentive for the landlord to do that, because now the landlord initially under the old law would make that investment, and then with the understanding that they would be able to recoup that over the next 10, 15 years, they made that they would go forward and try to beautify the property.
Under Which seems really reasonable.
Yeah, it does. And under the new law, unfortunately, the max that you could do is a 2% increase across the board. And believe it or not, after 30 years, you have to roll back that increase. You have to roll it back. So whatever increase, if there was, say, a $10, $20 increase to that tenant's apartment on a monthly basis, after 30 years, you have to document and track all that stuff. And after that time, you've got to go back to that tenant and say, okay, now your rent is being rolled back by the increase that we took 20, 30 years ago.
So would it be fair to say that one of the unintended consequences of this new law would be that building owners might be less inclined to maintain their buildings because they're not going to be able to recoup their costs?
That's 100% accurate. It's not an inclination in the sense that, they just don't want
That's
to.
That's what I mean. It's a business. I mean, hey, there's only so much money to go around.
Exactly. I mean, the money comes in and the money goes out. So if there's money coming in to pay for major capital improvements, then it'll be done. If there's no money coming in to pay for them, then it would be foolish to make those expenditures with the knowledge that it could bankrupt you down the road. The same thing applies to the individual apartment improvements that you were alluding to earlier. And so separate from the MCIs, which the major capital improvements, which apply to the building-wide systems, the IAIs, the individual apartment improvements, are improvements done to an apartment after a tenant vacates. And I was mentioning that earlier, that under the new law, the most you can invest is $15,000, and the most you'd be able to add on to the rent would be $89.29 if you invest.
So I can't spend more than $15,000 and recoup it for each apartment.
You can, but again, there's a disincentive too. So it'd make no sense for a landlord to spend more than $15,000 if they're not going to be able to get some of that back over the course of the years. Now, under the new law, you have to divide that $15,000 by 168. So it's going to take you around 14 years or so to recoup that. Under the old law, you would divide it by 40. So the payback period was a lot quicker, and there was no limitation. So if you take a three-bedroom apartment and you want to gut the kitchen, gut the bathroom, gut the apartment, put new sheetrock and new electrical and new plumbing, it's going to cost you way more than $15,000.
For sure, right.
So, but the legislators didn't take that into account. They assumed that, whether it's a studio or a three-bedroom apartment, $15,000 is enough. It's not, and it's going to create a problem.
And I think I'm a big housing advocate.
Sure.
That I'm chair of WRO, which is a housing organization. So, for as much as I do appreciate the kind of the intent behind this law, these yeah. unintended consequences are what worry me,
yeah.
because now I know that really good people who own multifamily housing and big commercial multifamily housing yeah. with the best of intentions are not. It's not an issue, like you said, of wanting to improve their buildings. It's just the financial capability is just not going to be
right.
there. So instead of giving people good, affordable housing, what we're doing is we're going to make it harder to get housing, and I think they're going in that the housing stock itself physically is going to suffer.
The quality of the stock you're not going to see suffer today, but in the next few years you're going to see it suffer. And maybe you not personally, because you're not walking inside the apartments, but the rents will, clearly the rents will be coming down, but in conjunction with the rents coming down is the quality of the apartment stock going down, and that's the part that's sad.
So when you say rents are going down, because we've been talking a lot over the last 18 months mm-hmm. of the show of what the cost of real estate and cost of rentals and housing and things, and rentals have been steadily going up.
Yeah.
Would you be saying that all rentals will continue to go up or come down, or just the ones that are in the large multifamily units?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think your analysis and the reports that you speak about are there for the four or five units and below. And they're not subject to rent stabilization. So if you have a four or five unit house and a tenant vacates, states, you could do whatever work you want to do to the apartment. There's no rent regulations. You could make any improvements you want or not, and you could charge whatever you want or not. Whatever the market will bear is what you could charge for rent. So, and more importantly, the reason I think why those rents are going up and why the price and why the sales are going up is because people are now disincentivized in buying multifamily units that are subject to rent stabilization. So that means if it's six units or more, and if you're a buyer, first-time investor, and you're on the fence about buying a six or seven or eight-family building, and now you see that the new law creates a problem for you to buy that, it's going to push them to buy something in the four and five-unit size. And that's why I think that market has been boosted up quite a bit, because there's a lot more buyers chasing those properties that would normally be in the market buying larger unit buildings.
Now, and that's a great observation, because as we were saying earlier in the show, the highest performing segment of the market in the last, gosh, year is the two to four family unit, or two to five, for your world, family units. And that just inventory is down. Prices are going, you know, really high. And that, you know, people are, we're bringing them on and we can't sell them fast. We can't bring them on fast enough. Yeah. And that's a really good observation. It's a great observation about these people who are maybe, because we do get calls from people who want to build their wealth through real estate. And look, historically, real estate's a great place to build wealth, no doubt about it. But that instead of that instead of that 8 or 10 unit, kind of that entry level size multifamily commercial property, the new law is just restricting their ability to grow their wealth, and that also, the smaller properties are going to boom even more.
Sure, and it's not going to be as easy to get the loans that were readily available in the past, because now banks are faced with the same analysis. You know, are they going to?
Let's talk about that. Actually, that's important, because people, I think, not everybody's a cash buyer.
Right. Most people are.
Most people are not. Right. And I know that when we had Kevin on, he was talking about, and Kevin is a residential lender, specializes in four and below. And that once you hit the five, at least in the lending world, the five and up is where it becomes a commercial loan. So, let's talk about that.
Well, my experience is that, and speaking with commercial lenders myself, is that the banks had to change their analysis on how they figure out how they're going to lend money. And what was in the past, analysis that whatever the rents are today, they're going to go up at some significant percentage year after year.
Ideally.
Based on the old law.
Or some steady percentage even.
Yeah, exactly.
Like up.
But now banks are looking at that differently, if my understanding is speaking with brokers, mortgage brokers, and they're telling me that now they've recalibrated their analysis, and as a result, there's less money to lend on these transactions going forward.
Is it because they don't believe that the income will be going up as steadily or at all? Or
They factored in the new law, in the sense that they realized that what was going to be a steady increase is now longer. I'm not sure whether their analysis is now flat or whether it's a 1% or 2% increase year to year. I'm not really sure about that, but I could tell you that they've had to reanalyze it. I've had a lot of brokers speak to over the phone, and they were trying to figure out how they're going to reanalyze their portfolios and how they analyzed, you know, doing loans in the future. So I know there were some changes.
And that's really tough because, you know, again, build wealth, right, through real estate. And nothing goes down in cost. I mean, you know, right? And Westchester County is a beautiful place to live. I wouldn't live anywhere else.
Sure.
But it's an expensive little place to live. And so I know that just costs associated with maintaining a home, you know, is like I'm about to do a bathroom at my house. So just doing any work, that cost doesn't go down.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. So now that the rents are capped, but the expenses continue to go up and up and up, it gets to a point where the margins get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Until
they're non-existent. And then the question becomes, what am I doing here? Why am I just scraping by to try to collect some rents to put it back into taxes, utilities, oil,
And taxes
insurance.
Are certainly not going down?
No, and water. So all the expenses are going up astronomically, and without there being some kind of match with an offset with revenue being increased, I think it's a matter of time where there's going to be some issues in the market.
So what are you foreseeing? Because let's face it, right? It's a double whammy. So costs, as we've just said, are definitely not going down. The potential for earnings is definitely going down. So look 2 years or a year. What is the future forecast? Is it 6 months? Is it 2 years? Is it 5 years? When do we think this like significant impact is going to, or is it here already?
I think loans are coming due. Commercial loans are coming due. The typical commercial loan is 5-7 year maturity. In the past, in the last 20-30 years, as far as I've been practicing, the logic was is that you could do a five-year loan, refinance the property in 5 years, pull more money out, and then reinvest
it. Leverage it and go buy something else.
Leverage it, you know, fix up the property or buy something else or do both. But that whole scheme has changed. So now in the past where owners were okay with their loan coming due because they'd be able to pull some money out and make the improvements
they
wanted to.
Because they had equity that grew.
Now there's no equity. In fact, you know, across the board, as I speak to people in the industry, you know, they're all the consensus that the property values for commercial properties dropped 25% at least.
Since June or just in the...
Since June, yeah.
Wow.
Maybe earlier because there was...
Because it was already the buzz.
It was coming, yes. But here's the reality. If you're, you know, a homeowner, I'm sorry, if you're an investor and you want to buy a 6 or 10 family house and you bought one, say, last year, and you paid just round numbers, $1 million. Say $1 million, okay? And the bank is going to lend you 75%. So you have the $750,000 mortgage and you have $250,000 in equity. After this law came out, poof.
You have zero equity.
You have zero equity. So now they have nothing. They have nothing in the property. They own really. There's no equity. There's no assets.
Do you think we'll see foreclosures increase?
I would not be surprised if that comes down the road in the next year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, when people are forced to refinance the properties, and they had lived a lifestyle where they thought they were going to be able to, you know, make that improvement and take a little bit more money out to pay those investments. So if they made investments in the property and they was hoping that a refi would be able to pay down those costs of improvements to the property, it's going to present a problem.
For sure. Yeah. You know what? We're going to take a quick break,
sure.
But then I have a really good question for you when we come back.
Okay.
Hey,
wait.
We're talking to Jim Dabini, Dabini & Associates, and this is Leah Caro talking real estate with Leah Caro, broadcasting from...
Pasquale Ristorante. Pasquale Ristorante. Pasquale Ristorante. Pasquale Ristorante. From the heart of Italy.
Pasquale Ristorante is the perfect dining experience. Your favorite Italian comfort food, plus the comforts of home away from home. Pasquale Ristorante has been treating you like family for nearly 20 years. And if you need catering, Pasquale will take care of it. Pasquale Ristorante, bringing family, friends, and food together.
Pasquale Ristorante treats you just like family. Pasquale Ristorante, an Italian specialty.
Pasquale Ristorante, 2 Putnam Avenue in Port Chester.
Westchester Talk Radio is broadcasting live.
Welcome back to Talking Real Estate with Leah Caro. I, of course, am Leah Caro, president at Park Sterling Realty, which is headquartered in beautiful Bronxville Village. We serve Westchester, Putnam, and Bronx counties. We are joined by Jim Dabini of James Dabini & Associates, law firm in Yonkers, New York, who has been giving us a really good in-depth analysis of the new tenant-landlord law that came into effect this past June and what it means to the real estate world. So welcome back, Jim.
Thank you.
When we left off, and you know, I just want to segue real quick, is that if you didn't get to hear all of the previous hour or so, or if you've missed any of our previous shows, you can always go to westchesterrealestate.com, look at the Talking Real Estate with Leah Caro podcast, and choose by topic what you'd like to hear. Also, you can go to the iTunes store and download the app of Westchester Talk Radio. You can also check out my LinkedIn profile, Leah Caro. I have all my podcasts there as well, and our social media and stuff like that. Anyway, so Jim, we were talking about how the unintended consequences of what sounded like a great law to address affordability issues for tenants in Westchester County has gone a little haywire.
Right.
And that for the 5 unit and above owners, or 6, let's call
six,
it 6, because I know in the finance world it's 5, but
yep,
in the
exactly.
legal world, for the law, it's 6.
Exactly.
And the 6 unit and above world, this law has really got some terrible consequences for owners who want to reinvest in their buildings and maybe someday sell their buildings and what the financial impact will be to them.
Sure.
Here's my question to you. You know, and none of us have our magic 8-ball out. Actually, I do have a magic 8-ball in the car, but
you don't make your decisions based on that, do you?
It depends on the decision. You could ask Doug Kaloris about that. Is there a point in the near future, far future, that it makes sense to be an investor in these type of properties, or is this market just kind of cooked for now?
Well, I think it's on a case-by-case basis. Each property has to be analyzed And you really have to dive down in the documentation what the potential for the increase in revenue is going to be down the road. As I mentioned earlier, in the past, you could just generalize, and people were looked like brilliant investors by making purchases based on summarizing numbers. Now you really have to dive down deep and really analyze this information. That's where a good realtor will come in handy and help you understand those numbers better.
And an attorney who I cannot stress this enough. You've heard me say it when you come to me with your Uncle Sid, who does probate, and I say, no, you can't use him. You need a real estate attorney. If you're looking at commercial real estate, you cannot just use any old real estate attorney. You need a real estate attorney who works in the commercial sector.
And that's me, Jim Dabini.
That is Jim Dabini. and that's why I had Jabini here today, because there's not a voice in Westchester right now who I think is being listened to more than yours when it comes to this new law. Because you're really out there. So if I was someone who thought that I'm going to build my wealth based on real estate and multifamily housing, it used to be I would just look at the rent rolls and what does it cost to heat the place and what does it cost? Sure. It was very fairly simple analysis of rent versus expense, right?
Yep.
And that whole equation has changed.
Yep, it's gotten more complicated. You have to analyze what the current rents are, what the potential rents are going to be, what the likelihood of those apartments turning over, and I don't want to get too complicated, but there's something different. There's two types of rents that are on record with the DHCR. One is called legal rent, and the other one's called preferential rent. So, and without boring your audience, if a good landlord has been managing the property, they're able to document a legal rent which is higher than what the tenant is actually paying. And when it turns out that tenant vacates, under this new law, the landlord will be able to bring that rent up from what that tenant was paying to what's called the legal rent.
The legal rent is not market rent.
Correct. So the legal rent could be $2,000. The market rent could be, say, $1,500. And another name for that market rent may be considered preferential, but it may be lower than the market. But under the new law, when that tenant vacates, you would be able to bring the rent up to that legal rent. So it would eventually go up to that $2,000 number. That's the only still remaining potential to make a significant increase in rent if a landlord has been documenting the registered rent, has been putting it into the leases. If he's been doing everything proper, then he's able to do that. A lot of landlords, unfortunately, are not savvy and don't know what legal rent is and don't know what preferential rent is, and they do their own registrations and they just put in a number, and that's the number that this tenant has happened to pay at this particular time. I've seen these numbers bounce around on registrations that I represent clients for all the time, and there's no rhyme or reason, and those are the problemed properties that are going to have a devaluation in property by any savvy investor who analyzes these numbers and realizes we've got potential problems here. These are all time bombs waiting to explode once we buy the property.
So if I've been a good landlord in my 8-unit building, and I've treated my tenants well, I've maintained my building, but my paperwork, maybe not so much. Is it too late for me to get my act together?
No, it's not too late. It's not too late. You need to speak to somebody who knows what they're doing with rent stabilization law, such as a person like myself, and we sit down and go through all their rent rolls, go through the registrations, make a request for documentation from DHCR to see what's been done, how it's been filed, and then go through all the improvements that are made to the property and to the apartments, and then work from there and reestablishing and creating the registrations so that we could get the client's valuation back up for them.
And one other question, if I'm the landlord, do I want long leases right now?
Well, if it's rent stabilized, you have a choice of 1 or 2 years to offer the tenants. So it's not an option of 3 or 4 or 5. If it's fair market, which is 5 units or less, it depends. It depends on where you think the market's going. I'm not a big fan of leases longer than 2 years, but there may be some circumstances where that makes sense for the homeowner.
Right, and so, looking out at the future, I don't want our segment to be all doom and gloom. I really don't, because I'm always looking for opportunity. First of all, sure. I do want tenants to know that they have some new good rights, which are important.
Without a doubt,
which was, I think, the intention of the law that went horribly astray in the process. But I don't want to be too doom and gloom, so I'm wondering, is there any opportunity out there? Is there an upside to any of this?
I think it's going to have to play itself out over the next year or two. I think right now the sellers are still of the mindset that their property is worth pre-law change. So they're still the mindset, well, yeah, I want to sell my property, but I'm selling it for X. But the reality is it's no longer worth X because of this new law. And there's buyers out there who have money on the sidelines waiting to buy stuff. But in taking into consideration this new law, the property is just not worth the X that this seller is wanting for it. So I think as time goes on over the next year, I think when sellers have to sell, I think you're going to find these prices coming down to meet what the true new market value is, and buyers will start getting active again in the market.
So if I said, Jim, will you come back in 6 months and join us and let's see where we are and take market temperature again? Yeah, would you do that for me?
100%.
Now, in the meantime, if I wanted to get in touch with you, where and how would I do that?
Sure. Well, my office number is 914-965-1011. The fastest way to probably get a hold of me is my email. It's jdibbini@dibbinilaw.com. That's jdibbini@dibbinilaw.com. I respond, you know, almost 24/7. So that's probably the quickest way to get a response.
And you mentioned a mailing list, which I, by the way, am on. Yes. So I get your newsletters. Yeah. If I want to get on your newsletter, how do I do that?
Shoot me an email. Shoot me an email at jdibbini@dibbinilaw.com, and I'll quickly get you on the newsletter. And you'll stay abreast of the new changes. There are changes, amendments coming out to this law. So if you're a landlord of any size, whether it's one or two family or 20 or 30 or 50 unit, you're going to want to stay up to date on these new laws because it could affect your bottom line.
Absolutely will. And I just want you also to know that both Jim and I are both working really hard in talking to our legislators to get some amendments made or to see about getting some tweaks to this. Sure. And they want to hear, by the way, you can contact me, Leah Caro, or caro@parksterlingrealty.com, or Jim. And let us know your true life anecdotes and stories. I have, as legislative chair of the Hudson Gateway Association of Realtors, we do have the ear of the politicians and the legislators and the elected officials who, you know, they're always running for office, who want to know what the impact has been. And they need some true life anecdotes. They just don't want to hear just from us.
Yep, likewise. Send them on to me as well so that I can communicate them also.
Absolutely. So you've been listening to Matt's getting ready to play the music. Don't play that music yet, Matt. You've been listening to Talking Real Estate with Leah Caro. We have been broadcasting live from G. Griffin Wine and Spirits in Rye, New York, everybody's favorite wine and spirits store, where service is number one and dogs are always welcome. Don't forget to stock up for your Thanksgiving needs. We'll see you on the radio next month. Bye.
Thank you, listener. Yes, Shark Creative is the company you think of for on-hold messages. If you want to hear how it helps, you can call Mercedes-Benz of New Rochelle, Durante Rentals, Michael Labriola, Inc., Oak Ridge Staffing, Emma's Ale House, Northeast Environmental, or just go to sharkcreative.com and listen there. Meanwhile, we've expanded our services as your all-audio resource. On-hold messages, of course, production and placement of radio campaigns on the Pete and others too. And now we also have our very own internet radio station, Westchester Talk Radio. Look for us on Facebook at Westchester Talk. Have us come out to your next event, help you capture audio from your sponsors, associates, friends, bite into that first impression with Shark Creative. Everything audio. It just sounds better. Shark Creative.